as I was saying, today we're going to be talking less about a specific style and more about things that you can use no matter who you're writing for, no matter what your context. Specifically, what I want to look at today is three particular areas where I see a lot of issues. And interestingly, when I probably did more research than I usually do for these slides today, both because it's harder to write sentences that are wrong than sentences that are correct. So that took me a little while, but also because I was trying to dig up what editors' biggest pet peeves are. And I got a lot from people who edit novels. And those were more about story, which we're going to talk about next week. But there was a dearth of ones from editors that weren't simply proofread or make sure I know what you're talking about in the very first sentence. But the thing is that a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today, like I said, there's three specific ones I want to go over, feed into those issues. So if you saw the blog post or the email that went out before today's call, I talked about how there's basically three, and depending on who you ask, people also say this is different types of editing, but there's kind of three things that go into making quote unquote good writing. One of them is this technical aspect of writing that we're going to talk about today. Another is that choice craft aspect of writing in terms of choosing which words you're going to use, putting your sentences together in a certain order, choosing the details that you think will best fit the topic that you're talking about. And then past that is the content level, having interesting things to write about in the first place and having the information to carry your story along. And the thing is that I put those ones in order because that's how you should learn them. That's kind of how they're presented in school. But also, you need the first and the one below that for the further off ones to work. And what I've seen an increasing amount of is people who might write interesting words, who might have interesting facts that they've dug up, who might have really interesting stories, but the way that they've presented that has a certain level of textual incoherence that makes it unfortunately hard to read and thus unfortunately hard for an editor to assign or buy, even if they've already assigned it, which gets us into the area of kill fees. So I've had, for instance, a lot of people come to me recently saying, well, I'm just not getting responses to my pitches. And sometimes people have asked me for pitch critiques in these cases. And I often say that, you know, with a pitch critique, I can see a lot of different things that are going on with your writing that need help. And that typically traces back to specific issues with your idea generation. So often there's issues with a pitch that have to do with the idea. And I can look at it and I can see where in the process of coming up with ideas, they're having issues. But unfortunately, what I've been seeing lately is that some pitches themselves forget about, you know, how they're presenting the idea or if the idea is good, but there's just glaring mistakes in the writing that would put an editor off no matter how the quality of your idea is. And unfortunately, a lot of these mistakes, like when I talk to people about it, they don't realize. So that's really what we're going to go into today. So in terms of this stuff we're going to talk about today, like I said, I come up with these things quite often in my current work through editing people's pitches and also editing folks that are writing for us in the database. But I've also spent time in the past as a magazine editor and also editing in-house at a university. And one of the reasons that I really wanted to talk to you guys about this right now and the reason why we're taking a little bit of time to focus on this is that I've really seen a resurgence, isn't quite the right word, but I've really seen an uptick in the amount of submissions that are lacking in these areas of writing. And it's the kind of thing where if you are trying to move to a different level and finding that you're not getting traction, this might be why. And it's something that no one is ever going to point out to you, unfortunately. If your ideas aren't quite on the mark, then an editor will say, hey, that's not right, quite right for us. But if your pitch is just off in one of these more basic writing ways, then they're probably just not going to respond at all, or they'll just say something more akin to a basic no. So if you're getting those types of no's, then this is a really good indication that this is what they're actually saying. So before we start talking about those three things that I mentioned today, why are we talking about something in terms of the sentence level? And last week, like I said, we talked about AP style, but we talked a lot about specific words and word choices and capitalization and different things like that. But the reason that I chose to focus on the sentence level today, in part, is because we're going to look at other types of construction. Next week, we're going to look more at a story arc or a narrative arc, or how you'd put together a narrative feature. And then the following week, we're going to look more at the craft of the personal essay, which is different because it doesn't have a narrative in that same way, but it still has its own sense of flow. But today, I'm talking about sentences, and I'm not talking about paragraphs. I'm not going to talk about paragraphs in a future week per se, because sentences are universal. You use them always. But the types of paragraphs you use and how they lead from one into another depend a lot on whether you're doing more, let's say, journalistic writing, or if you're doing more narrative writing or essay type writing, or if you're writing online. And so we're going to focus this week on the sentence, in part because of that, but also because this is the level at which I see a lot of issues. Because misspelling is something that Microsoft Word, or even, you know, just my web browser does it for me, or Grammarly can help us out with a lot. But sentence structure and what's missing and what's wrong is where a lot of these app-based functions falter. And I had mentioned before that Grammarly has some really basic issues where it won't notice if there's a word missing in your sentence, even if it's a sentence that has no noun or verb entirely. It won't notice if you have any of the issues here that we're going to talk about today. So that's another reason why I'm looking at these, because they won't be caught by the different apps that you might use, hoping that they will actually be catching these for you. So these are the ones that you really need to know, because no one else is going to tell you. So first of all, I asked earlier before we got started how many of you were familiar with the concept of dependent clause and independent clause, because those things are going to come up a lot today. But I'm going to say, just for the sake of getting us all on the same page, really quickly, what is the basic kernel of definition of a sentence? So a sentence, at a minimum, is a subject and a verb. Now, you'll see in a lot of online writing, and I certainly do this and a lot of other people do as well, that there are sentences that are composed of one verb or one word that may not be a subject or a verb. It might just be an adjective, or it might be a list. And that's something that's quite particular to web writing. But as they say, you need to know the rules before you can break them, and that's what we're going to be looking at today. So I've given you a couple examples here of the same sort of sentiment of the first person and then the verb go, with a lot of different verb tenses. And if any of you guys have learned foreign languages, this will no doubt probably bring back horrible memories / shuddering, or at least some kind of memories. But I did this for a reason. So I want to show you that this is a sentence that is just a subject and a verb, and it can get increasingly complicated, but it can get much more complicated than that. And so I took this simple sentence and I added a destination. I added, I went to the cafe, but, hold on, there it is. Okay. But that one sentence, I went to the cafe, can be a sentence on its own. But then, this is the same sentence. This is a sentence about going to the cafe. And it is, in fact, one sentence, which is 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 lines long here in this 28-point font, which was the smallest I thought I could make it and have you guys still see it. So I'm going to just see for a second if I can put the slides back on, because it'll make it easier to read some of these longer slides that I have going on. But no, sadly, it still says it will be uploading in 2 minutes. So I'm just going to read this to you for those of you who are following along by phone. So I took that sentence, I went to the cafe, and I turned it into, when I was in London, which was pretty often during this time, because my friend, my old roommate from Boston, actually, had landed a flat in a very posh central London neighborhood that allowed you to walk anywhere you'd want to go, We often went to this cafe, at first because it had amazing dishes from all over the world, like perfect Swedish cardamom buns and full Japanese breakfast. But later, we found out it was connected to a very witty intellectual magazine and was regularly frequented by the magazine's editor. So we continued going, hoping to run into one of them and get an in with the magazine. Now, there's a couple random errors that are in that sentence because I was writing it sort of trying to point out different things and didn't notice those in the beginning until I read it to you. So let's ignore those issues for now. But I want to show you that this super long sentence, which is in fact one sentence, and for all sort of, you know, editorial grammatical purposes could probably be left that way if it actually absolutely needed to, contains all of these different clauses. So every time I switch between the italics and the normal font is where we're switching clauses. So you'll see, for instance, here in the middle, this offset clause is in the middle of another clause. So we go between 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 clauses here in this sentence. So this is the same thing as I went to the cafe, but in this sentence, we're giving all of this context. I went to the cafe, why I went to that cafe, why that specific cafe, some description about that cafe. Now, the thing with this sentence is that I often hear from people, especially people who come from not a lack of a writing background, but other writing backgrounds, particularly writing backgrounds that are, let's call them drier, like technical or science writing or also legal writing, that they want to write flowery prose. They don't know how to write in this flowery, descriptive fashion that you see in travel features or in books. But the thing is that that flowery, descriptive fashion is often something that they're using to describe sentences that are very long. Not necessarily people who are writing, you know, an obscene number of adjectives. They're often being written with a lot of details which get packed into sentences in these really obscene ways. And I remember when I first started doing this thinking that I was only writing like this because it's how we write in Italian and also in German. They write really long sentences and it's totally fine and nobody complains about it. And it's just this horrible holdover that I have from having gone to college essentially in another language. But then as I got more into journalism, I realized that when you are writing journalistically and you are trying to pack in an obscene amount of detail into the very short space that you have, writing more sentences where you have to create subjects and verbs and connections actually just uses up your word count. And so a way to save word count is to shove a ridiculous number of clauses into one sentence. And I was just reading, not in preparation for this call, but for other reasons, a book by somebody who is at originally a pastry chef, but has turned into a bit of a writer by virtue of having a very well-read blog and also writing quite a lot of recipe books that often include his stories. And I was reading the very beginning of his new book, which is coming out next week, and I noticed that the first sentence was exactly something like this. It just went on and on and on and on. And I thought, wow, what a way to start the very first page of your book. Like, that's ballsy to put that out there right at the beginning. It really sets the tone. But the thing is that if you look at a lot of feature articles and a lot of journalistic articles, even if they're a bit shorter, it's very common that that first paragraph, which is really just one sentence, looks quite a bit like this. So let's look at a couple different things that are going on here. So you'll notice at the end of this paragraph that I had, which is one sentence, but we'll call it a paragraph, that there are two bits here, where I say a very witty intellectual magazine and was regularly frequented by the magazine's editor. There's no comma before that and, where I say intellectual magazine, comma, and was regularly frequented, because I'm talking the subject here. If we go back, we later found out it. So the subject here is the cafe. So it was connected and it was regularly frequented. So there's no comma here because the subject hasn't changed. Now, the second time that happens is again here at the bottom. So we, now the subject has become we continued going, hoping to run into one of them and get an in. So we hoped we were hoping to get an in. So because, again, the subject hasn't changed here, and even the verb hasn't changed, because it's hoping to run into and then hoping to get an in, there's no comma in the middle of those two things. This is a really, really frequent issue that I'm seeing, and to the point that I think people have just kind of come around to, you can put commas wherever and as often as you want and it doesn't matter, which is this odd extension of the Oxford comma that we're going to talk about a little bit. And if you joined us last week, you already heard me talk about, but it's not correct to have a comma in those two settings. Now, if you were having three different verbs in a row, that would then make it correct. And we're going to look at that later and how to make sure that you address those things properly. But another thing that you'll notice is that, as I mentioned, there's 10 different clauses in here, and some of them are offset in slightly different ways. So for instance, we've got this one, which is offset by M dashes. An M dash is the long dash, and an N dash is the smaller dash. So that's the EM dash is a longer dash, and the EM dash is the shorter dash. I know it's hard when I say it to quite hear the difference, so I'll just put it here in the chat box. So if you are doing that kind of offset, it needs to be done with the EM dash, okay? That's the correct way to do it. And if, depending on which style system you're using, there may be spaces before and after, and there may not be. So that's something that you need to look at the publication that you're writing for and how they do it. So in this case, and in our sort of in-house style guide, I do it like this, where they are in fact connected. And that's sort of offset there. I'm not going to get too much into base punctuation right now, but that offset of the M dash is something that I use sort of gratuitously, which is another kind of Italian holdover, but it's something that I've also seen people use, I wouldn't say incorrectly, because it's something that's a bit hard to do incorrectly, but it's important to remember that any time of any kind of punctuation like this, if it's an M dash or if it's a semicolon, which I didn't shove in there, you should avoid using them in anything you're sending to an editor unless you're 100% sure that you know the correct way to use it. So for instance, the semicolon, and if anybody's not sure what that is, I'll pop one in the chat box. The semicolon, whoops, that's a colon. And then this one is the semicolon. The semicolon is intended, whoa, it actually won't let me put a semicolon. What's happening? There we go. The semicolon is intended to separate two complete sentences. So do you remember when I was talking above about how a sentence has to have its own verb and subject? And those can be repeated, but they need to be actually repeated, you know, on the page, not as an assumption. Then you can use the semicolon in the middle, but they need to be two complete sentences. So that's how to use that. The dash, like I said, is more liberal, and I don't have a slide about how to use those incorrectly because, like I said, I don't want to get too much into punctuation, but I just want to remind you, if you're not sure about a particular bit of punctuation, just stick to the comma, or just stick to the basic comma period combination. You really don't need more than that, unless you like to write really long sentences like I do. So the way to write really long sentences is to use a collection of these different types of connectors. So I've given them a couple different names here, which I've sort of created. I'm not giving you the grammatical names because they're ugly, basically. And so I'm giving you ones that I think are easier to remember and that make more sense. So connectors are ones that connect, I'm going to talk about two different types, but they connect different thoughts. So sometimes they're going to connect independent clauses, and sometimes they're going to connect dependent clauses. And so we're going to look more at that further on. But I've just highlighted here the ones that I used in this long sentence, and we're going to look at some others later. But then there's also ones that are extenders. So like and that are interesting in that there's a lot of discussion over when you should use those and if you should use like at all, because people overuse it. And we had quite a spirited discussion about the use of like the other day, because it was myself as a former Californian and another Californian who was a former Kentuckian talking about the use of like in California with someone Finnish who uses like to a beautiful level in her spoken language for someone who's not of American extraction. And she was explaining that it was something that she picked up to make her American sound more correct. And the thing is that because it's become such a mainstay in spoken American English, I've noticed it often creeping with incorrect usage into written English. So if you are using like in your written English, it's important to make sure that you're using it in a place where it actually belongs rather than as you would use it in a spoken fashion. So in this case, the way that I have used like is I said that there were amazing dishes from all over the world, comma, like. So if you are giving a selection of items and it is being offset, you would want to put a period in there, or sorry, a comma in there. But if you're saying it was like a light blue color, that's the kind of case where like exists in spoken speech, but it wouldn't necessarily exist in written speech. And you should just say it was a slightly light blue color. So in this case, like I said, I've used it to put off a list of examples of the phrase here, dishes from all over the world. So I mentioned earlier how a lot of people have this concept that you need to be flowery or wordy to write like a quote unquote real travel writer. And I talked about how I think that that is less about the word choice that people are using because quote unquote good or real travel writers aren't just using a bunch of random adjectives in a big long list. They are choosing things very precisely to illustrate the points and the sentiment and the sense of place that they are out to illustrate. So what is it that creates that sense of flowery or wordiness? So I talked a little bit about the sort of journalistic implications and how you want to shove as many things in your word count as possible. But I also pulled up this quote from Mark Twain. So as some of you may know, Mark Twain was not just a novelist. Before that, he was an ad man. He wrote advertisements and he was also a journalist. And he had a very funny book about the German language. And that was actually the quote that I was trying to find for you, but it wouldn't come up. And I think it was because it was in German, but he was talking about how sentences in German, similarly to that sentence that I wrote you, can be up to an entire page long. And how that was one of the ludicrous things about the German language. But you'll see here, and I'll read this quote for those of you who aren't able to see the slides, you'll see here that he basically abhors long sentences in the first place. And I think a lot of this comes from his work doing advertisements, more so than journalism, because in advertisements, they try to keep the sentences very, very short to make them really, really readable. Because first of all, they're often physically displayed on billboards and things like that, and space is a premium. And if you shove too much stuff in there, then the words won't be visible at all. But also because they get to spend so much time, they get to spend, you know, like 3 months figuring out what is the perfect sentence for that thing. And so if you've heard the Mark Twain quote, which I suppose isn't actually a Mark Twain quote, but is often attributed to him, I'm writing you a long letter because I didn't have time to write you a short one. That kind of gets back to this sentiment. So I'll read you this quote, which is actually to the best of people's ability to know from him directly. So he said, "I notice that you use plain, simple languages, short words, and brief sentences. That is the way to write English. It is the modern way and the best way. Stick to it." Note the semicolon. "Don't let fluff and flowers and verbosity creep in." Now, it's interesting because in this sentence where he says, "Don't let fluff and flowers and verbosity creep in," he is allowing his sentence to become longer than it needs to with this additional "and." We're going to get to lists in a little bit. He says, "When you catch an adjective, kill it." No, I don't mean utterly, but kill most of them. Note the em-dash. "Then the rest will be valuable." So this is also, for a second, to look at the em-dash. This is another way to use the em-dash, which is like a semicolon to separate two dependent clauses, two full sentences. He says about adjectives, "They weaken when they are close together. They give strength when they are wide apart. An adjective habit or wordy, diffuse, flowery habit, once fastened upon a person, is as hard to get rid of as any other vice." Now, the reason I want to discuss this is that this talks about two different things. So remember I mentioned how wordy and flowery people often think that they're talking about the use of adjectives. And here he talks about adjectives. But then in here, he also is talking about simple language, short words, and brief sentences, which is quite different than all this stuff about adjectives, if you think about it, because you cannot use adjectives. And as I showed you, still write quite long sentences and use big words if you feel so inclined. So the thing about, like I said, quote unquote, good writing is that there's a lot of things that go into it. Using active verbs. See here, he says they weaken rather than they make your text weak when they are close together. Using one word when rather than five. These are all hallmarks of good writing. But you'll notice in here, his sentences have quite a bit of variety. If you look at where the commas and em dashes and semicolons fall just on the page, the way that it looks here, you'll see that there's a lot of variation in the length of the sentence and the types of divisions, types of punctuation that he uses. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you about sentences, is that it's so important to learn how to use different ones. And let's get now into talking about clauses so that we can look at that. So this whole idea, hold on, okay. Sorry, this is why I don't like to run the webinar on my computer rather than on the thing. Okay, so the whole thing about sentences, I said we're going to look at three different issues. So the correct use of commas, dangling modifiers, and agreements and lists. So before I get to that, I just want to comment on the use of the Oxford comma. So we talked about this last week, so some of you may have been here last week when we talked about that, but if not, I want to explain quickly. So the Oxford comma is when you use a comma before the and at the end of the sentence, no matter what. So the example that I gave, and this is my favorite example, is I'd like to thank my parents, comma, Mother Teresa, and the Pope, with no comma in the middle. So the Oxford comma would dictate that you would say, I would like to thank my parents, comma, Mother Teresa, comma, and the Pope. But if you don't use the Oxford comma, you open yourself up to this ambiguity of it sounding like your parents are Mother Teresa and the Pope. So that's why I personally like to use the Oxford comma, but I see a lot of people who have been trained not to use it. And it is AP style not to use it, yet a lot of publications will use it anyway. So in terms of commas, I'm not going to talk about this Oxford comma, which is the list comma, but we're going to talk about grammatically necessary commas. So I mentioned that in terms of connectors, there's really two different kinds. There's the ones that bring two fully independent clauses together, and the ones that don't, that bring together a dependent and an independent clause. So I asked early on, who had experience with the terms independent and dependent clause. And some of you haven't encountered those at all, and some of you have. So I'm going to give a little just explanation of this. If you've already heard about them, bear with me. So the basic concept at the most kind of definitions for each one level is that the independent clause has that subject and verb that we talked about. It has everything that qualifies as a sentence, but it's a clause because it's going to be joined with other clauses. But you can just think about an independent clause as a sentence because that's a much easier way to think about it if you're new to thinking about this. So an independent clause functions on its own as a sentence without needing anything else attached, whereas a dependent clause is lacking in something, a subject or a verb, typically the subject, in order for it to become an independent clause or a full sentence. So we're going to look at a lot of examples when I talk about lists and when I talk about the dependent versus independent clause. But for now, for this conjunction connectors, I want to just talk about bringing together two full sentences. So when you're doing that, like I said, you're going to have two subjects and two verbs on each side. So that means that in order for these two sentences to be joined in a grammatically correct fashion, there's only certain words that you can use And you need to put a comma before that word. So the one that we see most commonly is and. And I mentioned earlier when we looked at my very long sentence example that the reason that I didn't have the comma before those two ands at the end was because those sections were not sentences. They were not independent clauses. They did not require the comma before the and because they were just the verb parts. They didn't repeat the subject. And that's why they weren't full independent clauses on their own. So you can definitely see instances where and is used in a list where you don't need the comma. And the same goes for but and or and yet and so and for and nor. So these are all ones where you might see them instead in a dependent clause construction, but they're the only ones that you can use to conjoin two complete sentences together. So this is really important to remember that if you have two things that you want to connect and you don't want to use one of these, you're going to have to either use a period or one of those other punctuation options that we looked at earlier, like the EM, the long dash, or the semicolon. Okay, so let's look at the subordinate connectors because there's a lot more of these. So these are the connectors that add a dependent clause to an independent clause. So what this means is it's very frequently going to be things like because blah, 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 this happened, or since blah, 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 this happened, or though blah, 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 this happened, or now that blah, 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 this happened, or after. So it's typically going to be something that's a reason that's explaining the sentence that comes along after that. So the thing about that is that it's very important, like I said, to remember that the words we talked about on the previous slide are for connecting to complete sentences, but these, this much, much longer list, is for an incomplete sentence. So what that means is that you need to make sure that as you are writing this up, that the clause that you have written is dependent on the main clause to make sense. So I have some later on that are specifically dealing with dangling modifiers where you'll see this in action, but just to give a couple ones. I could say, you know, because it didn't upload, the slides can't be played through the Webinar Jam's viewer, and instead I'm running them on my computer. So we're going to look at how to make sure those things match up later, which is often involving a bit of gymnastics, which I just had to do as I was making up that sentence for you. But we'll also often see ones like, provided that you arrive on time, you can attend the show. But that's a little weird, right? Because I said they need to not be independent clauses, but it seems like you arrive on time. That could be a sentence, right? But when you say provided that, you need to know what the provided that is. So that's why a lot of these sentences kind of, or a lot of these words have contingencies. So supposing it doesn't rain tomorrow, my flight will leave on time. Or now that I have my train ticket, I can board the plane. So sometimes they will be sentences that if they didn't have that subordinate connector involved, they would function on their own. By adding that, it needs to have a reason. So hopefully that's not too much of a struggle. I know, like I said, it's a little hard without the examples, but we're going to see some more when we talk about modifiers. So let's look at the modifiers. So there's two names for these, and they're two slightly different issues. So you'll often hear them called misplaced or dangling modifiers. So I looked for a bit to find the reason that people call them dangling, and I have to say I didn't love any of them, and they all kind of were slightly different, and none of them sounded 100% convincing. So I'm going to explain to you the whole category at once. So essentially, the issue with a misplaced or dangling modifier is when a modifier and those things that we just talked about, those subordinate clauses, those after, though, in the event that, whenever, because of, in the case of, those are all the beginnings of modifiers, right? Because it's in the case of something. So they're modifying something. They're modifying some main event. So there's a lot of things that are not quite so clearly those subordinate clauses that we looked at that are going to be modifiers that we're going to talk about as well, but those will come up here. So they have to modify something. So if the thing that they are modifying is not appropriately connected to the modifier, that is when you get into this misplaced and dangling situation. So I've got a bunch of right and wrong ones for us to look at. So the first one I've got here, I've slightly separated them into if they come before the main clause or after, but I want to show you here how I had to do some of that gymnastics that I talked about. So the right way is I had to go to the event on Wednesday, which was the day it rained or it poured, and that sucked, because I had not packed an umbrella. Whereas it looks like I cut and pasted these wrong, but in any event. So the wrong version is Wednesday was the day of the event, which was the day it poured, and that sucked because I had not packed an umbrella. So in this case, the issue is that Wednesday is the part being modified by, which was the day it poured. So it's very important that which was the day it poured, because the subject is lacking in here between which and was. So we need that Wednesday to be attached to the modifier, which was the day it poured. So what that means is that if you wrote this sentence in the first place, you would need to go and fuss it around to put it in the right order. So let's look at some other ones. So these ones are all much simpler, and I only wrote them one time, so they're all correct. So I gave a couple where I put the right one first and a couple where I put the wrong one first. So let's look at the first bit. So I said the correct version was, I was so excited to take our anniversary trip in Greece. Okay, so we're modifying the word Greece, which was where my husband had proposed. So now in the second one, which is very similar to the one that I had earlier, I said Greece was the perfect place for our anniversary trip, which was where my husband had proposed. Now, it seems really simple that you would say, oh, instead of this, I would say Greece was the perfect place for our anniversary trip because that was where my husband proposed. And that's a totally fine way to fix this as well, or a different way to say this. But part of the reason it's important to look at these which examples is this is one of those ways that a lot of journalists use to really not pad out our sentences, but to take advantage of word count. So rather than saying the lengthier, Greece was the perfect place for anniversary trip because that was where my husband had proposed, we can say I was so excited, or we can say our anniversary trip was to Greece, which was where my husband proposed. You can use this which to cut out a lot of the words of making two separate clauses, which is why I had mentioned earlier that a lot of journalists favor this, you know, clause after clause after clause approach, because it allows them to get more words into their word count. So let's look at a couple other ones. So this is one that I found online. I've tried to choose examples that were a little more travel writing related, but this one I just liked because I see this exact thing all the time. So in this case, the correct version is after reading the original study, I find the article unconvincing. So it's very important because there's no noun in the beginning to say the noun right away, because this is what we are modifying. So in the previous example, we had the main clause first, and then we had the modifying clause. So then we need to make sure that the word that's being modified comes at the end so that it can attach to the modification clause. But here it's the opposite. Here the modifying clause comes first, so the subject or the noun being modified needs to be at the beginning of the main sentence rather than at the end. So the way that I often see this kind of thing is, as it says here, after reading the original study, the article remains unconvincing. So the author of this sentence has implied that they read the original study, or if in the previous sentence they were talking about a character in the book, it would imply that the character in the book had read the original study, or if it was a journalistic article and they were talking about a source that they had spoken to who was an expert on this topic, then they might think it implies that it's talking about the expert. But this is one of the most common dangling modifier instances that I see. And this was what actually got me started on this whole topic a few months ago, was that someone had sent me something that had quite a few of these. And when I, you know, broach the subject with her, she told me that she had put it through Grammarly. And this is when I figured out that Grammarly was missing all of these issues. So this is something that you absolutely need to kind of make a note on the side. If it doesn't immediately jump out to you that this sentence is wrong, you know, copy that over, write that down. But that's something that you want to keep an eye out for, is these initial subordinate clauses followed by the noun, the subject that is not the same subject, the explanatory subject of that original clause. Okay, so now let's look at some with the wrong sentence first, and maybe some of these will trip you up. So this is very similar to the one above, but it's one that I wrote with more of a travel angle. So since traveling to Greece, octopus never tastes the same anywhere else. Again, this is the kind of thing that I see all the time. And when you just hear it, or if you just look at it, it makes sense. But the issue is the ambiguity and the lack of appropriate subjects here, because basically even the second part doesn't have the subject. The subject is to whom it doesn't taste the same anywhere else. So the correct version here would be, since traveling to Greece, I find octopus never tastes the same anywhere else. So somebody said, that's why I have another person read what I wrote to point these out. But a really good tactic that somebody taught me a while ago is that if you have a certain error that you know you have an issue with, or if you have, I was actually taught this with words that people overuse. So for instance, if you overuse that, which I used to as a holdover from Italian, or if you have a tendency to use the name of the place you're writing about too often, or if you have a word that you always misspell, you can just make a little checklist for yourself. And once the piece is all ready to turn in and you think that you've proofread it, or you've proofread it to the best of your ability or the time that you have, just run a quick search for those things. So in this case, you know, you could skim through your piece and look for every sentence that starts with all those words that we showed earlier. So like after, although, since, before. So obviously these are a lot of words, but most of us don't use all of them. So you could just run a quick search for because or since or so, and just make sure that all of your modifiers are correct. So let's look at this last one here before we move on to agreement and lists, which is another huge offender that I see all the time. All three of these are really huge offenders, but that, similar to this dangling modifiers one, is one that I don't see standing out to people. Just like with the commas, like I think that people just don't know what the rules of where they must put them versus where they shouldn't or where they could if they like to. So for this last modifier, I've actually given a couple examples, and these are, of course, freelance writing related. So here's another super common type sentence. After turning in the assignment, the editor still hasn't responded to any of my emails. So it's obvious to us that it's after I turn in the assignment, right? But for it to be correct, that does need to be in the sentence. So you can simply change it to, after I turn in the assignment, the editor still hasn't responded to any of my emails. Or you can put the subject in the other bit. So this version, like I said, is where we've turned it into two separate clauses, but the after has made the first clause dependent upon the second clause. So another way of keeping the first clause pure and subject free is to say, after turning in the assignment, I've emailed the editor several times and still not received a single response. So like I said, any of these ones that are wrong, there's usually multiple different ways that you can change them, and that's up to you. But it's important to catch these things. And like I said, these are the kind of things where they're often going to be in your pitch letters, where they really do you in. If it's in the article, then the editor can kind of be like, okay, well, as long as there's not 25 of them, you know, they spent a lot of time on this and maybe they just put that in at the end. But if it's in your pitch letter, they're really going to notice it. Likewise with lists. And lists have a tendency to come up in your pitch letters because you're talking about all the different things that you're going to cover in the article. So I put two in here that I think are very much the types of things that would appear in your pitches. But let's first talk about what the issue is. So the first issue is, or sorry, like the explanation of the issue is this. And I found this example online so I could find one that was adequately basic. So I work quickly and am careful versus I work quickly and carefully. Now, this seems a little weird, right? Because it seems like there's nothing specifically wrong with this, I work quickly and am careful. Like, it seems like, you know, we haven't added a comma here, so that's right. Like, I work quickly and I am careful. That seems like it all agrees. So what's the issue here? So the issue here is that the list should be around I work. So I work quickly and carefully. So this is why I was saying it seems a little weird, some of these things, that they're grammar rather than style. But it goes back to what I said in the blog post and in the newsletter that was leading up to today, which is that it's all about what makes your prose, your copy, your text the clearest read for the reader. And this is one of those cases where it's another word that doesn't need to be there. So what I often see in these lists is this lack of agreement, right? So agreement here is I work quickly and carefully. So we've got two words of the same type. So there's a couple different issues here. So this one that I just showed you with having the verb and then adverb and then continuing with another verb rather than the adverb, that's one that comes up. People often will change the subject within their list, even if they have other items within their list that are verbs that have referred to the same subject, okay? Or another one you might see is where there's some items in the list. See here, they've correctly at least done I work quickly and am careful. They've retained the same subject here and they have a verb. But what sometimes happens is that they'll be I work quickly and am careful and everyone says so, where now they have a different structure entirely, because it's not just that they've changed the subject, but it's that there's no subject here. So they've changed the subject, but they've also added a subject where there wasn't one previously. So that would work with this first sentence if we were to say, I work quickly and everyone says I'm careful, and my boss frequently comments on how detail-oriented I am. So in that case, we have a list that's three complete sentences where the subject has changed every single time. So that would actually be okay. So let's look at these examples. So I said the destination has the highest concentration of theme parks in the world. You can visit a variety of different beaches, and it's easily accessible from many airports. So the issue here is that I've kept this subject verb. So we've got destination has, you can, it is, but the issue is that two of these have the same subject. So it would be really better here is rather than pulling this one into you can visit a variety of beaches, would be to say the destination has the highest concentration of theme parks in the world, access to a variety of beaches, and accessibility from many airports. So what I've done here is I have taken the destination has description, and it's the description part that I'm repeating every time. So the destination has the highest concentration, access to a variety of beaches, and accessibility from many airports. So I've made it all agree that they are all nouns. Now, the kind of next level version of this agreement is to really make sure, like I said, not just that you're continuing a verb if it's a verb, or you know that you're continuing in this case the adverb, but that you're really making sure that you're using similar words and similar descriptions on those words so that your list doesn't become imbalanced. Sometimes for entries for the database, I see this a lot where people will give me a list sentence where they're talking about different articles that have appeared in this section in the past. And for each different article that they talk about, even though they're trying to have it in one sentence, they have a totally different modifier. So sometimes they'll have one article where they'll say this article has included three things, and this article they'll have a sentence that has a different order of things. And those things just need to be separated out into three sentences. So this is the kind of case where if you wanted to keep this like this, you would need to just separate it out into three different sentences. Now, in the next one, I've made a super glaring error, so hopefully you guys will all hear it when I read this out loud. So, upon stepping onto the main street, I was immediately hypnotized by the steady beat of the car and bicycle horns, the stark colors of the flashing signs atop each minuscule shop, and pushed to the side by a steady stream of foot traffic. So let me know if you spotted what the issue is in that sentence in the chat box. And not the issue that I'm going to correct on the screen right now, which is that there's an extra into, but the issue with the list itself. And if you did spot it, tell me what it is. Great. Yeah. So what happened here, and I'm going to try to mark it up here, is that I said the subject is I, and the verb was I was immediately hypnotized by. So this is what we're looking at here. I'm going to change this into a different color so we can see the difference. So then for this subject, what I was hypnotized by is we've got this steady beat and then the stark colors. But then in this last bit, I said, and push to the side, okay? Now, this makes sense with I was. So what I could do to make this work is I could say, I was immediately hypnotized by the steady beat of car and bicycle horns, dazzled by the stark colors of the flashing signs, and pushed to the side by the steady stream of foot traffic. So if I did that, then we've got three verbs that all mirror, and then it works. But in the present state, or in the previous state, because now I've changed it, in the previous state, we were either, depending on how you look at it, missing the central verb, or we were having an additional verb here, because you could say you were immediately hypnotized by the steady stream of foot traffic as well, similar to the steady beats, but I'd probably like to change it so I didn't have the word steady twice. So this is one of these things that shouldn't be difficult to spot. And you'll notice, for instance, when I read that big long sentence earlier, that there was some issues with it, like it should have been editors plural rather than editor singular. And I'm going to go back and change all those things before we put the slides up for the coaching students. But that those errors, I noticed them as soon as I read it out loud. So if you're like, you know, Carrie mentioned earlier, if you're like, wow, this is why I have other people read my things, what do you do when you can't find someone else to read your work before you have to send it to the editor? You read it out loud. I have a friend who is a like 5 times New York Times bestselling author. And every year when he is on his kind of annual, just get the F away from it all vacation with his wife, they sit together and read his entire new book out loud looking for issues. So reading it out loud is really the best way to catch those things because you can't skim over them the same way you do when you're just reading it. So I really recommend that. But now you know some new things to look for that you might not have known before. So hopefully at least some of those for some of you, like at least one thing for each of you rather, was something that you weren't quite clear on before that you are now. So thanks so much for joining us today. And hopefully next week I'll have complained enough to the webinar provider that we'll be able to get our slides working. And thank you so much for bearing with me on that. And I hope you were able to see everything, and we will catch you next week. Bye guys.